Today, I'm speaking with Dr. Kirk Freudenberg. Kirk is the Brooks and Suzanne Reagan Professor of Classics at Yale University, as well as the chair of the department. He's an expert on the ancient Mediterranean world, with a focus on Roman literature and poetry. In particular, we discuss his latest book project, a study of Virgil's Aeneid, and the highly cinematic visual nature of his storytelling. We also discuss the values of the classical world that we can glean from the Iliad, the Odyssey, and the Aeneid. Without further ado, my name is Sebastian Weatherby, and this is The Tell. Kirk, thanks for taking the time.
Sebastian, it is my pleasure.
What is your background for how you became a classicist?
Becoming a classicist, I was a pretty good student in high school and college, but I had nothing that really caught my interest, and so I was very lazy. And so somehow in the course of my career, my undergraduate career, which was all over the place in terms of majors and exploring, which I guess is the way a liberal arts education should work.
Yeah.
You eventually stumble on something that catches your interest. And for me, that was stumbling into an ancient Greek course, taking Greek 101, which I liked because I saw some other people who I thought were nerdy and driven taking that. And I knew it was hard. And I took it rather for weird reasons like that, because I wanted that kind of challenge. And so I started in on Greek late in my undergraduate career, but that's what caught my interest. And then after that, I thought, this is what I want to pursue. And so I dived into classics as a discipline, which is much more than just taking ancient Greek. And for me, it involved taking Latin at a very late stage in my career. And eventually, that's what I settled in on, where my main point of focus is in Latin literature.
That is, from my perspective as an archaeologist, the most intimidating aspect of classics is the linguistics chops that one needs to develop.
Sure, sure. And I know that archaeology and classics have a lot to do with one another and have much to say to one another. But the disciplines, and it works in the other direction as well.
Yeah, yeah.
Where classicists are very, or tend to be very focused on literature and the languages, they can do some other disciplinary things beyond that, such as epigraphy or history, for example. In my department, we have archaeologists who conduct digs, and so we have a nice conversation, and I think that's the approach that we have in my department, is to have a very full house where...
Multidisciplinary environment.
Yeah. Exactly. And so students can flow in from a literature course into a course where they're going to get trained up in methods of archaeology and actually go on a dig and all that stuff. And so they can explore all the ways you can investigate the ancient world from one place.
Yeah. Knowing that you recently finished a book about the Aeneid, that's what I read first prepping for this interview, but I also was reading the Odyssey a couple weeks ago during some field work. But in general, while reading both, what I was really trying to imagine and think about was just the worldview and the values of the people of the ancient Mediterranean. Now, I imagine the Aeneid is, you know, being the product of a literate period by one man, it's probably a little bit less representative, but at least is a lens into a Roman mind.
Yeah, well, we can back that up a little bit and think in terms of when we're talking about Virgil. Of course, Virgil's Aeneid is this grand epic from the late 1st century BC by Virgil, who himself had a career as a poet before he hit the Aeneid, and he's interesting because his earlier poetry actually still exists, the eclogues and the Georgics. And so in the eclogues, for example, which is his earliest big work, they're character-driven poems where shepherds are up in the fields minding their flocks and singing songs about love and being in nature, things like that. And this is an old form that goes back to Hellenistic period authors such as Theocritus working in Egypt.
Uh-huh.
And Virgil's very aware of that precedent, but he does something radical in the very first poem we have of his, and that is he brings Roman political realities crashing into this shepherd's world, which is this ideal world. And he has one of the shepherds, one has lost his property to the civil wars, And this is something that happened to Virgil himself. Mm-hmm. And so it's always been, Virgil's always been that poet who brings Roman cultural realities crashing right into it, very contemporary stuff. Roman civil war was going on as he's writing these things. And he himself, he was from landed gentry, as you say, from way up in northern Italy in Mantua.
Yeah.
And it all depended on the political landscape of the region you were from. And if you were on the wrong side of this civil war and you owned property, it was taken from you. And this happened to Virgil. He lost everything. But in the story that's told in that first poem, the one shepherd loses everything, but the other has everything lost. But then he has a sort of savior character come in, and he goes to Rome and he talks to this person, and he manages to keep his farm. So this is the one thing about Virgil and his friend Horace, and I've done an awful lot of work on Horace, is that both of them were on the wrong side of the civil wars. Both of them fought against the Caesars.
But then, like, the Aeneid was sponsored by Augustus. So how did that switch happen? How did Virgil go from fighting on the other side of the civil war to writing for and sponsored by Augustus?
Well, there's the question is, we'll return to the sort of for and sponsored by, because it's all, there's a tendency to think in terms of pro or con in these things. But when you dive into their poetry, you see both sides of these things all the time, where there's a pressure on the pro that pulls you away from it, that doesn't quite let you subscribe to it fully. So Horace lost all of his property. He was from southern Italy, from Apulia, and he was rescued basically by Virgil. Virgil introduced him to Maecenas, who was sort of Octavian. Later on, he becomes Augustus, but he was Octavian's right-hand man and a very powerful political figure who was taking care of everything in the city of Rome while Octavian was out fighting these civil wars. And so Maecenas was this magnificent, he had tremendous political savvy, and he was gathering up poets based on who had the best talent. And he was gathering up poets who may have written from the other side, from the other perspective. And Horace actually fought in the Battle of Philippi.
Oh, wow. Okay.
In the late 40s BC, on the wrong side for Brutus, for the killers of Caesar. And he lost everything as a result. His ancestral farm was taken from him and all of that. But because Virgil knew him somehow, this is a bit mysterious how they came into contact early on, but they knew each other from a very, from early on. They're roughly the same age, about 5 years apart. And Virgil had already landed with Maecenas. Maecenas had chosen him. In fact, in the word for patron in Italian is his name, Mecenate.
Huh.
Yeah, and it's the same way in German. Mäzen is from his name. He was such a powerful patron figure that his very name becomes the word for patron in a lot of European languages.
Wow.
So the scale of wealth we're talking about when you have someone like a Maecenas is unbelievable. You know, basically, Virgil was set up for life by this relationship. We know from later sources that he received a million sesterces for his Aeneid. And for Horace, he was taken on and given a villa in the Sabine Hills where he could write his poetry. And by villa, I mean not where you're growing cabbage. It's a big luxury villa. And archaeologists have dug a villa out in the Sabine Hills, which they think is probably the villa he writes from when he writes his famous odes, which is roughly contemporary with the Aeneid. So
when Virgil writes the Aeneid, do we have a sense for the original intent? I mean, to what degree is it foundation myth or adventure story? And how much is it a departure from the Homeric epics, or is it very traditional?
Yeah, you raised the issue of the Odyssey earlier, and you see all these similarities. The early books of the Aeneid are about Aeneas's travels after the fall of Troy. But in terms of adventures, it's not as good. You'll notice that as well. You know, with Odysseus, you get Cyclopses and sirens and all that storytelling he gives to the Phaeacians, which are, you know, from the greatest storyteller of all, which is Odysseus himself. Aeneas is not as good of a storyteller, and his adventures are not of the, you know, fighting monsters type, or going off the edge of the world into unknown lands. In Homer's Odyssey, Italy is basically unknown because it's beyond the scope. And so that's one of the interesting things that Virgil does, is he breaks all these rules with his epic. One of the rules is that, for example, you're within a Homeric milieu here. We remember the Iliad and the Odyssey, and you keep within that frame. But no, right away in the first book, he blasts away that boundary.
Right, so it's a transgression. So even by making the historical connection, drawing the thread from the mythic Aegean to the historical Rome.
And right down to his own day, the coming of a certain, this person, Augustus, and how he's going to rule an empire without end.
Right, right.
In fact, there's a famous mosaic in Tunis in the Bardo Museum there of a Virgil character, and he's surrounded by two muses. And one of them is singing into his ear, and the other is listening with her hand on her cheek. The muses are not the muses of epic poetry. Whoever did this mosaic knew what made Virgil so original. One is the muse of, the one who's listening silently is the muse of tragedy. And the other who is dictating to Virgil as he's writing is the muse of history. Which you would not put either of those as, if you're going to picture Homer being inspired, you have to have Calliope there. Calliope, the goddess muse of epic poetry. But no, whoever did this mosaic knew that this is what made Virgil so very different. Because he could combine these different worlds into one epic. Return me to your original question. It had something to do with the Odyssey and...
Yeah, well, let me explain what got me thinking this about the values of the Greco-Roman world and how that's shown in the great classical epics. That's really why I was asking about differences between the Aeneid and Homer's epics. There's a historian named Tom Holland whose book Dominion I read recently, and one of the big themes of this book is how profoundly alien the values of the Greco-Roman world can seem to us moderns, and how you know, these themes of might makes right, and the emphasis on conquerors and piratical warlords and strong men, and sort of with that theme in mind, I was rereading the Odyssey recently, and one thing that struck me is how often when Odysseus arrives in some new place, someone might recognize him from the crowd, or he introduces himself, but it's always like, look, that's Odysseus, sacker of cities, stealer of women, slayer of men kind of thing. And then contrast that with the newly emerging and initially persecuted and quite controversial Christian perspective.
Jesus and St. Paul, flipping the script.
Yeah, exactly. It's like this great inversion. It seems like, to me, this great inversion of values from, you know, even like... Romulus killing his brother to found the city, or the survival of early Rome being dependent upon the rape of the Sabine women.
No, that's great. And it's one of the things I actually like about Roman mythology, about their founding, is there's so much that's not sanitized, right?
Was that a problem to any Romans, or was that something that they wrestled with?
Yeah. For example, Romans had lots of myths about their founding, okay? They existed all over the place until a rather late time when they settled in on this Aeneas myth, right? So some early versions had Odysseus as the founder of Rome on one of his travels. And if you ask anybody on the street if they knew, you know, if they had read a little bit about the ancient Romans, say, who founded Rome? They wouldn't say Aeneas, they'd say Romulus. That's an indigenous myth. That's an Italian myth. That's two brothers fighting for supremacy, one killing the other and founding the city of Rome. And it takes place in the mythic time scale we're talking about.
Yeah.
Hundreds of years after the fall of Troy. But then the Romans had it later on come upon this, we need Aeneas as our founder.
Yeah.
And how are you going to make those two myths work together, right? Romans knew this about themselves. They need all those myths. In other words, they need a myth that puts them there, as with Romulus, we come from the soil, right? But how can you really have that as your only story? You need a colonizer. Aeneas is that colonizer. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. He comes to a place that he's told by the gods, this is yours. Your old place is gone. You lead your people, and it's Jupiter's will that you take this place, yeah. And it's your new home. When he gets there, there are already people there. Aeneas lands here, and he's like Odysseus getting home. I'm finally home, but I've got a war I've got to fight. In the Odyssey, it's I've got to destroy these suitors and make it my home again. For Aeneas, it's there are people already here. So yeah, you need a colonizer, and you need the violence.
Right.
And they know this about themselves. This is one thing I think Virgil gets from Homer's Odyssey. There's this, you know, the famous Cyclops scene where Odysseus, he approaches that island as a sort of archaic Greek colonizer. He looks at the island and...
Yeah, he's like, imagine the fine olive groves that they could be growing on these slopes.
Exactly, exactly. And he's stunned by how stupid the locals are. He first lands on an island across from the Cyclops' island where it's just lush with potential from his line of sight. All this undeveloped potential. There's so much rich wildlife. And he says, and there were grasses growing here. You could have grain fields. You could have, and it's a wonderful harbor, but there's no harbor there. All he basically looks at is if only a Greek were to come here.
Right, right.
And clean this place up. And it also makes clear he had no reason to go to the Cyclops' island. They had everything they needed right where they were, but he makes it a point to go across in a ship and explore, and it causes a disaster, not just for the Cyclops, but for himself.
Yeah, yeah.
But you remember how that works in, he goes there expecting the monster to respect Greek protocols, you know, and to, you know, give him a gift and all of this stuff. And the Cyclops says, Zeus, I don't care about Zeus. Zeus doesn't rule out here. And he eats his men and does all these very non-Greek things. And he, in a gift-giving culture that binds foreign peoples together, the Cyclops says, I'll give you a gift. I'll eat you last, right? So all these Greek protocols are flouted.
Yeah.
Cyclops
yeah.
doesn't even know
he's,
how to...
He's the archetypal savage, isn't he?
Exactly. He's the cannibal, doesn't know how to drink wine, which is, if you think of the archaic Greek symposium, it's all about maintaining control and learning to be a civilized Greek human being through these communal structures. And wine plays a huge role in that. And so Cyclops is totally ignorant of all of that. He can't even wear clothing that's woven. You know, he wears animal skins and things like this. So he's the outsider as viewed by this a cultured Greek colonizer who
right,
sails
yeah.
off in a place and expects the locals to respect Greekness, and they don't. And that surely was the case in a lot of 9th and 8th century colonization, which was huge. It was going on, and this is Homer's writing this or singing this song at a time when the Greeks are already for example, off the coast of Naples. That was their earliest colony in the 730s BC. And the Phoenicians are already there, too. And so the Odyssey kind of reflects colonization as being swept off into these crazy, violent places, but also to these super places like the island of the Phaeacians, where it's all song and dance and high technology. And many have thought that these are modeled after the Phoenicians, right? A different colonizing culture. So all of this comes into the Aeneid in certain ways. I'll take that one thing about the Cyclops is by the time you're done in that cave, you're kind of feeling sorry for the Cyclops.
Yeah, yeah.
You notice that, how he flips the script on it. It was all about Odysseus and his curiosity, and he doesn't care what he has to do now to kill this guy. In the end, that Cyclops, Polyphemus, was just minding his sheep, and it tugs at your heart. And later Greek poets exploited that potential. They would write poems. For example, Theocritus writes a poem about the Cyclops as a kid, a sort of prequel, which sort of tells you why he became so violent and everything. And he's an abused character all throughout, right? But that's what Virgil, that one little instance in the Odyssey, Virgil takes that, and he does that all the time. He shows you, yes, rah-rah Roman project of colonizing the world, bringing this sort of empire without end and peace to all under Augustus, but he always lets you see the cost of everything along the way. Look at Dido, right? She's sort of the Cyclops in her own way, just minding her own business. And no one feels for Aeneas in this story, right? It's always, Aeneas says, well, I got to go. I've been booted out. Jupiter wants me to finish my mission. So he does that with all of these characters. It's like trapdoors all throughout the second half, which is the battle half, the Iliad half of the Aeneid. He gets you to sign on. You know, he invites you in and to love someone or to back them or to hate someone. But then he flips the script on you, and you begin to regret. You say, wait a minute, where am I supposed to be here, right? There's a famous example of a character named Mezentius, who's an Etruscan kind of tyrant figure, a hater of the gods, and everything about him is horrible until Virgil paints his death at Aeneas's hands. And you get to see a side of Mezentius. He becomes this Cyclops character that you... And you wonder, what just happened to me here? I thought I knew this character, and now he's got all these sides of him that are being brought out after the death of his own son that you see he's actually rather marvelous. And you sympathize, and that's a consistent thing that happens throughout the second half of the Aeneid, is that it becomes hard to say who the enemy is and who the good guy is. For example, in the Iliad, and it's Achilles who's the killer, the heartless killer, until the very end, when for one little moment acts like a human being in the very end, where he has to negotiate, where Priam, the king, negotiates to get back the body of his dead son.
Mm-hmm. Hector.
Exactly. And both men are weeping together. And for once, Achilles sees the humanness of someone else. And of his own self, he now knows he's going to die. And he dwells on what he shares with Priam. And for once, he's a human being, and he hasn't been all along. He's always been obsessed with his divine background, his mother, you know.
Right, right.
Thetis, I'm the son of a goddess. But at the end, it's all about his father, and his father is a human. So Homer flips that at the end, and Virgil sees these potentials.
It's really interesting to think about Virgil in this sort of academic dialogue with older works. That on its own seems like a striking difference from the Abrahamic tradition.
It's everything's out there as Homer hasn't come along to sort of set things in a kind of biblical frame where you don't deviate, right? You see this in Greek tragedy where it's all very flexible, right? Because there's no sort of authoritative text that says, and there's no belief system here that would demand you subscribe to any certain version. Mythology kind of exists city by city in antiquity because it's not a belief system per se. It's not what, as you mentioned, Christianity. There's no sense of needing to believe these stories and no one requiring you to do it. And so that kind of is a mystified certain people about the Christians and their demand for a certain belief that something is the case, because that wasn't part of religious thought at the time, not per se, anyway.
So as you've been researching and writing about the Aeneid,
which seems like a huge mammoth task, trying to say novel stuff about a work like that. What kind of approach have you taken? Do you have a thesis or sort of a core thrust to the way you've approached it?
Yeah, you're right that writing about the Aeneid is daunting because it's like writing on Shakespeare or something. My main approach was a little different in that I approached Virgil's storytelling as analogous with Homer, but when you think of Homer as a storyteller, think of Homer where he's performing these things, right? These are oral performances. It's not even clear that Homer knew how to write, mm-hmm. because writing is just coming online, the Greek alphabet, just shortly before he comes along. So his songs would be performed at these regional or sometimes Panhellenic festivals for the gods. They're religious performances, and they would take days to perform, and he would do it from memory. You know, you've read the Iliad,
yeah. Right?
You know, yeah. How long that takes you to read. Now imagine someone sitting down there, closing his eyes, and starting to sing, and going on, and maybe you go four books that day, and then the sun sets, and you do it again, and somehow, after it's all done, he could do it all again, and it would be pretty much the same story. I say closing his eyes because that was kind of my important point, is Homer is always depicted in, well, he's described and depicted as blind, right? The blind singer, because Homer's poetry is so visual. He wants you to see what he's saying.
Mm-hmm.
And he has all these techniques for getting you to visualize song. And so the proper way to appreciate Homer, I thought, was to close your eyes and to take it in as song and to see what images come before your eyes and how they move. And so I was very interested in the idea of the techniques of storytelling that get you to imagine, right? And so I did a lot with sort of comparing things to the way stories are told in film through visual means.
Yeah, yeah.
The way in which you move from one scene to the next and how directors and cinematographers use visual imagery to get you to see things that don't just sort of help you understand the story, but are telling the story, right? So, for example, in silent film, you can go from scene to scene to scene, and you know what's going on. And only once in a while will you get a little snippet of text that you have to read, right? So you can do an awful lot of the load of telling a story can be just the way in which cameras move about and look at characters, then move over here and there and there. That's very well developed in film studies, in that the way you move from scene to scene is the realization that most of what happens when you are viewing a film, you're doing. The director is just giving you sort of cues to perform certain operations that help you put the whole story together. And so, for example, later on in the Aeneid, in Book 12, when Aeneas is hunting for his archenemy Turnus, and Turnus is being swept away by his sister, who's a divinity, Aeneas is hunting for him and can't catch up to him. And Virgil uses the image, a simile of a swallow, a black swallow that has a nest, and it goes out and it's flying all around the atrium of house, and then it goes out and it catches something and brings it back to the nest. And he uses that as an image of how Aeneas was moving about. And he uses the word black to describe the black swallow. But he uses the word swallow two lines later. So he says this black flies, blah, blah, blah. He goes on about how it flies around. You can hear it chattering. And only a couple lines later do you know that it's a swallow, because that's when it lands in the simile. All that time, you didn't know what that black thing was until two lines later, it lands. And that helps you imagine how hard it is to see something. A flittering chaos until finally it lands. You can see it, and then boom, it goes flying off again. And that's how Turnus is moving about. but as seen by whom? Virgil makes it clear that it's Aeneas who's seeing all this. What's out there is about the insides of someone else who's viewing. And that is a very enriching thing, because usually when people study ancient epic, it's like, oh, well, these ancient writers don't know how to take you inside a character. The only thing that matters is the stuff on the outside.
Right.
Right? They're totally externalized, in other words.
So really, this would be an underestimation of the sophistication of ancient storytelling.
Exactly. And we tend to pat ourselves on the back of, you know, later novels teach us how to get really inside of a character. There are ways inside of these characters. It's just, it's hiding in plain sight. It's about visual storytelling and the way that it carries a story load. And so, for example, when Aeneas is leaving Carthage in the fourth book, he's already, you know, he's dumping Dido, saying, I gotta go. And Dido is losing at this point. She's going to commit suicide by the end of the book. Virgil describes Aeneas leaving the city of Carthage, and he gives you a sort of bird's eye view of them leaving. He compares them to ants carrying their loads, and he takes you down to see them very up close as individual people with their loads. And then he pulls back so that you see it as all the individuality blurs into a long black line as of ants. Then he says, he describes a long black line of ants, and he says, what were your feelings, Dido, when you saw this? So as you pull back, you are surprised to see Dido. It's all about what's going on in her.
This again seems like you're giving the ancients the respect they're due, in a sense, showing that the visual description of things aren't just a matter of aesthetics, but scenes are really being shot in a cinematic sense.
Shot, yes, that's the thing. Close your eyes and take in the same information as in terms of the way you're being made to see things.
Is it?
And at some point, I stopped thinking of these analogies with film as mere analogies. I thought, and here I was helped by some scholars who are friends of mine at Yale. One in film studies, his name is Francesco Cassetti, and he's a very well-known scholar of Italian cinema. And he's the one who really gave me a kind of permission, because he was so enthusiastic about what I was doing. As an Italian growing up in Italy, you know Virgil's Aeneid, you know? And he knows film. He's the one who said, you know, I said, well, you know, they don't have zoom. How can I make an analogy with zoom lenses and things like that? And he says, no, that's the way storytelling has always happened. The zoom lens was invented to do what we needed it to do to tell that story, right? But he's the one who put me onto all of this and said, don't think of it as a mere analogy. That's just storytelling. And I came to think of it very differently that way, and as essential to the story itself. And there are others who've been doing this, not so much with film comparisons, but in terms of classical narratology. But it was much better on the Greek side than on the Latin side for some reason. So
better how exactly, and why do you think that is?
Well, better in terms of taking that up as something to really focus in on. Roman poets tend to give you things to look at, but well, in Virgil's Aeneid, there are several big examples of what we call ekphrasis, which is when you take an item, a physical item. This is very schematic and oversimplified, and you describe it in great detail, a physical object. Homer does it in the Iliad when he takes the better part of a book of poetry, describe the new shield that Achilles gets. So much of the study of visuality in Roman poetry was focused on the way these poets do these static images and the way they describe them and the way they're structured and the way that fits in and matches the story and enhances the story being told. But there hasn't been the sort of proper attention in terms of the way it could be done. But even in the matter of ekphrasis, I take this. It's the first big ekphrasis of the Aeneid, a frieze on the temple of Juno in Carthage. And Aeneas, while he waits for for Dido to meet her for the first time, he's there studying this imagery. And it happens to be the Trojan War is depicted, right? So it's wonderfully meta, right? But I, instead of just talking about what's on the frieze, I talk about why is he focusing on this and this and this? What his, it's his experience, and it's about what he takes in and how hateful he is of what he sees up there,
right,
and how he's moving about the image. And so it's about, so it ends up being not about what's written on the temple or in the story on the temple wall in its depiction. It's the story that Aeneas spins from what he sees up there.
Right, seeing his character play out in the face of that frieze.
Exactly, and he leaves lots of things out. He focuses on certain things, which tells you what he's all about.
Now I feel like I've got to reread like all of the epics, trying to flex this muscle of focusing on the visual aspect of it all a lot more.
Yeah, and I think if you think in terms of the ancient performance context of a singer who could just capture an audience. I start the book with having readers look at an image of the poet Orpheus performing. It's from a 6th century BC red figure vase that's now in Berlin. I think it's there. Yes, I've seen it before. But it shows Orpheus singing, strumming his lyre out in nature with several Thracians who have come by, and they've been drawn in to listen. And Orpheus is staring up into the heavens as he sings. And the Thracians are all, one is looking at the ground. They're all lost. One is closing his eyes like this, and one is looking straight into his eyes. And they're all visualizing the story. That's where I had a great time with just inviting listeners to think differently about the performance context, where even for Virgil, people would have known this as this rumbling arma verumque cano Troiae qui primus aboris Italium fato profugus Lavinico venit. And it would have gone on and on and on, and they would have gotten into the rhythm of the song, and they would have turned their heads down and up and closed their eyes, and they would have been absorbed in imagining what the song that's being sung. We're not used to it because we don't have the patience
TikTok generation.
You know. But this is a world where people could sit for hours and hours and absorb song and storytelling because there's nothing else out there. That's it. And these singers were bearers of culture, you know.
Yeah.
Homer was thought to be something like the bearer of Greek culture for future generations. This song had to be memorized again and again and retold again and again because it gave you all you needed to know about certain things in life, just as the way Hesiod's Theogony or Works and Days gave you all you needed to know about this, and Orpheus comes in there as well, and just as the poet of cosmography and things like that. So, so I think you do have to go into a different world where you are capable of tremendous bouts of absorbing it all.
Yeah.
And I think we know this from film. We can sit there sometimes for 4 hours straight and take the ups and downs as they come and feel really satisfied at the end and want to do it again, right?
And I'm not sure it's actually been said yet. What is the title of your book?
Virgil's Cinematic Art is the main title. It's on vision. The subtitle is Vision as Narrative in the Aeneid, and I purposely chose that. It's not vision and narrative, it's vision as narrative.
Mm-hmm.
And that came out just early 23, just earlier this year from Oxford. So, and it's short. I wanted to write it as a easy read that someone, and this is sort of my way of protesting against a lot of things in my field, one of which is books that are way too long. And I wanted to write it in a way that could appeal to non-specialists as well as to have things to say for people who really have studied this stuff for a long, long time. Whether I've pulled that off or not, I don't know. It's not for me to say, but that was the idea. So it's got a kind of irreverent storytelling side to it in itself.
Well, I think this is probably a good place to end it. But I'll have links on my social media to your book and Kirk. Thanks again.
Well, Sebastian, I had a great time talking to you, and many thanks for listening.
And thank you for listening to this episode of The Tell. Until next time.